Good morning. Welcome to the class. Welcome to our visitors. Glad to have each of you here. We're going to be picking up the study in Acts 15 today. This study will take several class periods, several points that I want to bring out and for us to spend some time developing. Paul, in this early point in his service, had been plagued by Jewish opposition since he obeyed the gospel and began his work in witnessing for Jesus Christ. Even in the very beginning, Acts chapter 9, we saw not only in Damascus, where he was when he obeyed the gospel, but when he went to Jerusalem sometime after that. In both places, he was persecuted, even with attempts upon his life were taken. We saw that when he began the first journey. In one city, he was stoned and left for dead. So opposition to Paul and his teaching from the Jews was becoming something that he was expecting. Later on, he makes a comment in the book of Acts that everywhere he went, he received such persecution. And when he go to Jerusalem for his final time, he expected the same thing there based on what had happened to him in the past. These large crowds that he was drawing because of the gospel message were bringing jealousy on the part of the Jews, and they reacted to that jealousy again in Acts 14, even at the point of stoning him and leaving him for dead. But now in Acts chapter 15, we see a new element, and that is, in spite of gospel teaching and adherence to the law of Moses by some of the Jews who had professed Christ, came to surface. Now, the context talks about these Jews as being believing Jews. I'm not doubting that these Jews believed in Jesus Christ. Not doubting that they believed in baptism for the remission of sins. Not doubting those things. Okay? But it appears that while embracing Christ, they refused to turn loose of the law of Moses and wanted to bind the law of Moses upon these Gentiles who would embrace Christ. So they were, in effect, trying to proselyte the Gentiles just as had been done under the law of Moses. But they were trying to proselyte them now into the gospel of Jesus Christ by trying to bind the law of Moses on them. The point that it would center around appears to be circumcision, which, as you know, was in the law, but also had been in the promise concerning Abraham. So it was older than the law itself. But it seems to center around that. We're going to look at some things this morning and see, really, circumcision itself was just a small part of it. So that's what I want us to try to develop in this class today. Now, their profession of Christ had a suspect side to it. And if you will, open up to Galatians chapter 2. In the Galatian letter, there seems to be a parallel recorded there to the events that we're going to be discussing now. And that's something for you to read, and you see if you see the parallel, and then work with it as you see fit. But in the Galatian letter, Paul is defending his apostleship. The Jews were doubting his apostleship because of what they said he was doing, and that is that he was telling people to disregard Moses, to disregard the law. And in one sense, that was true, in the sense of it having been fulfilled, completed. Not abolished in the sense of, let's just get rid of that law and let's have a new law. But in the sense of fulfillment, that law was completed and done away with. Paul recognized that. Paul would never have been guilty of offering an animal sacrifice for sins as he understood the gospel of Christ. But he also understood that there were various aspects of the law of Moses that if people chose to, they could still adhere to. Some of the ceremonial cleansings and such as that. As a matter of fact, in the 21st chapter of Acts, Paul himself participated in one of those. So Paul recognized within the law of Moses those things that had to be done away with, could not continue, and were not compatible with the gospel of Christ. But that message was confused by some who wanted to maintain the entire law of Moses. In chapter 2 and verse 4, it reads, "Yet because of false brothers secretly brought in." And this idea of false brothers, I believe this is referring to what we refer to as Judaizing teachers. These men in Acts 15 who left the church in Jerusalem and went up to the church in Antioch and began preaching the circumcision and the law of Moses, and that for a person to be saved, they had to adhere to both circumcision and the law. He calls them false, and I believe that's from the concept that they believe and taught a false doctrine. Now, you can talk about attitudes, and we'll talk about their attitude. Their attitude perhaps has a suspect side to it. Their profession of Christ may have a suspect side to it. And that's what we'll look at here briefly. But he says here in verse 4, "Because of these false brothers secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy out our freedom that we have in Christ Jesus." This idea of secretly coming in and slipping in is the idea is evidently this was something they kept within their circle. Perhaps they were having meetings among themselves how to address this and bring this into the gospel of Christ. And of course, now we already know that from the first chapter, Paul asked this question to the Galatians concerning a false doctrine. He said, I believe it's around in verse 6 and 7, "I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who have called you into the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there's another gospel, but there are some who trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ." This gospel of Christ, you see, was being distorted by these teachings from the law of Moses to bring them in and to incorporate them into the gospel of Jesus Christ. So he goes on to say that they might bring us into slavery. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, over in the sixth chapter, we see something about these men. If we'll notice here in verse 12, it is those who want to make a good showing in the flesh, who would force you to be circumcised, and only in order that they may not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. Here were these men coming in, and they wanted to force circumcision on others. Was it because they thought it would be of help to the others? Well, perhaps. But notice what it says. But they desire, in order that they may not be persecuted for the cross. In other words, they had their own associates. And these associates they had were persecuting them, saying, "Well, why are you a member of this group? Y'all are disrespecting the law of Moses. Y'all are accepting Gentiles in, and they're not being circumcised." In order to avoid that persecution upon themselves, instead of trying to teach and explain the fulfillment of the law of Moses, they're bowing to the pressure of that circumcision, and now instead they are trying to force it upon those when they don't have the right to. And he goes on and says in verse 13, "For even those who are circumcised do not themselves keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised that they may boast in your flesh." They're not interested in keeping the law. They're perhaps not offering the animal sacrifices. They're perhaps not doing what they need to do. Perhaps they're keeping parts of it that's convenient to them. But he says they don't themselves keep the law, but they want to boast in your flesh. They want to be able to say, "Yeah, we told them. Yeah, we told them. And now they're going to be circumcised, you know." And so they're able to boast, you know, about what they've been able to do. So we see something about the motives of these men. The motives didn't have those they were talking to in mind, those who they would try to persuade among the Gentiles to be adherent to the law of Moses along with the gospel of Christ. They didn't really have them in mind. They had more of themselves in mind. Now, there's no evidence in chapter 15 of Acts that there was inspiration involved in the speaking that they did and in the conclusion that they came to. Now, there's inspiration involved, but I don't see the inspiration in what they spoke and in their reaching a conclusion. Now, Paul, in that same place we were reading in Acts chapter 2, but this time in verse 2, he says it was that by way of revelation that he went up to Jerusalem. He was in Antioch at the close of the first trip, he and Barnabas. And that's when these false teachers came up there. And so, being there, he went to Jerusalem, he and Barnabas and some others. And we'll see here in Galatians 2 that one of those was Titus. We'll talk about that in a minute. So, it says here in Galatians 2:2, I went up because of a revelation. Evidently, God told him to go. You remember, God had told Peter when he was in Joppa that when men came for him, he was to go with them to Caesarea to teach Cornelius. In this case, Paul told, through some measure, some way of a revelation, he told Paul to go down to Jerusalem to discuss this matter. And so Paul goes. Now, at the end of it, after the conclusion had been reached, then it says in the latter part of the book of Acts that the Holy Spirit agreed with their conclusion. In between, in the times of their discussion, we don't see the involvement of God. Now, obviously God had done certain things in the past, and so God was involved. But the conclusions they reached were going to be based upon those things that they had participated in, and the observations they had made, and thus conclusions they had reached based upon that. So that's something that, you know, to me is important as we go through this letter, because it's going to teach us as we go through this how we ourselves might reason when we have a question about things that are right and things that are wrong when it comes to the Word of God.
So your point is that they had enough information at the beginning of Acts 15. They should, and they did, draw the proper conclusions with what they already had. That's the point you're making, right? That God did not have to directly, the Holy Spirit did not have to send additional information. This was done with what they already had to prophesy. Of course, you're going to get into all that.
And we'll see that as we get into the statements made by Peter, statements made by Paul and Barnabas, and also the conclusion that James reached. We'll see that they had the necessary information, okay? And it's going to involve, though, the application of it. You know, we can take a piece of information and different ones off is going to do different things with it. But here we're going to see how they handled this information and what they did with it. And I think that's very important for us. Now, the events recorded in this chapter, I believe, serve as a model for the church today. To me, it's why this chapter is so important. Now, not everything to be learned on this subject is in this chapter. I don't want to put that idea out at all. There's many other points that teach us about, you know, the means of establishing authority that are not in this chapter. This is not an all-inclusive chapter on this subject. But the information that it does contain is very important. And the one thing it does teach us is how to think logically, how to reason from what we know is right, how to draw conclusions upon that, the process of drawing conclusions, and then to go with that, to take action based upon that. These are all things brought out in this chapter. But again, don't think that this is all the New Testament has to say on the establishment of authority and so forth. There's much more outside of this chapter. The we have to be concerned in our establishment of authority that we do not add to or take away from God's Word. Now, that's an Old Testament principle. We'll not go there. We're familiar with it at the close of the Revelation letter, where it's specifically addressing the words of this prophecy, no man is to add to or take away from. We're familiar with it there. And I don't know, as a general application to the New Testament scriptures, where there's kind of a parallel phrase that's worded so succinctly. But we have it, and if you'll turn there, please, to Mark chapter 7. And we're not going to spend a lot of time in Mark 7, but we see an issue here that brings up this concept of not to add to or not to take away from. Here at the beginning of Mark 7, the disciples had taken some grain and eaten it without washing their hands. And according to the traditions of the elders of the Old Testament, that was not acceptable. And so they questioned Jesus on it. And so Jesus, you know, answered their question in a way they didn't expect. He said, "The people honor me in verse 6 with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they do worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." What they had done here was, in effect, place a burden upon the people that the law of Moses did not place upon them. They had added something to the law of Moses. And the passage that I skipped over between the beginning of the chapter and verse 6 give a listing of some of those things that they had basically just said, well, you need to do this, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do this if you're going to be pleasing to God. It was simply their tradition. So they were adding to the law. And so now notice in verse 8, and I'm reading out the English Standard Version, it says, "You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." This idea of leaving the commandment is to loosen it. And the idea of holding to the tradition of men is to add to it. So they were loosening the commandment of God, and they were adding or binding the commandment of men. And he goes on to say in verse 9, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God." In other words, loosening man from the requirements of God in order to establish their own tradition or bind the traditions of man. And he goes on to say, as an example of how where God had said they needed to care for their father and mother, but they were not doing that because, well, we gave our money to the Lord. We have no responsibility to father and mother. So they were loosening the commandment of God. So now in the case before us, we have to be concerned about loosening and adding. So what these Judaizing teachers were doing, they were taking the gospel of Christ, but they were trying to add back in this law of Moses, trying to add that law back to what was being upon the law of Christ. Yes?
The point that you just made earlier, logical thinking, is, in my opinion, one of the biggest problems we have right now on our aspects of life. People are not thinking logically, religiously, politically, socially, and all walks of life. We're not thinking logically.
Well, I agree with that. Now, we're going to discuss it from this standpoint. We're not going to discuss it from all the standpoints.
Religiously and most importantly.
Yes, I agree with that, and we're going to spend some time developing those thoughts. I don't know if it's Wednesday or Sunday. I don't know, Lord willing, when. But but there's a sense of loosening here as well. Okay, but in this case, it's not the loosening as we saw in Mark 7, where the loosening was of man, where man said, "Well, no, you don't need to be taking care of your parents. Just give that money to the Lord, and then you can't take care of your parents. You don't have to." They're loosening that command. In this case, the loosening was done by God. And what was that loosening? In the case before us, the loosening was by God. The Old Testament law. Man was loosed from the Old Testament law. not because the law was no good, but because the law was fulfilled. It was completed. So God loosed man from this Old Testament law. But now man is trying to bind that back, you see. That's what we have to be careful of. We don't bind where God is not bound, and we don't loose where God is not loosed. Such as the case is before us. So this case is important, you see. Now, another point that I want to bring out, and that is understanding this chapter is mandatory for the young men, the future leaders of the church. Now, we're going to spend some time at the end of the lesson developing that thought some. But for right now, I just want to introduce the thought. And I want to introduce it this way to the young men from the standpoint of, I'll use the term challenge. I don't know if that's the best term or not. But young men need to understand this so that we might understand how to establish authority, so we might know how to interpret the scriptures, so that we might know how to come to the conclusions that God has intended for us to come to. Now, this chapter is very important to help us in that, achieve that. Now, in saying that, I'm not trying to place this chapter upon a pedestal and say it has an importance that, you know, ranks it above other chapters of the Bible. I'm not saying that. Consider this. In Mark chapter 4 and verse 13, and this is only in Mark's account of the Gospels, that he says this. But after Jesus had told them the parable of the sower, then he said to the apostles, to the disciples, when he was explaining it to them, he said, understand you not this parable? Then how will you understand all parables? The idea was, he was not saying that this parable is really the one you need to understand. Don't worry so much about the rest of them or anything like that. What he was saying is, this parable is about the heart. And until the heart of man is addressed, you're really not going to get through to him. You know, you can talk to him till you're blue in the face. If his heart is not right, if he's not wanting to obey God, if he's not wanting to listen to God, if he has no respect for God, you're not going to get through to him. So this parable was about the importance of the heart. And so it was teaching that we have to understand that parable in order to be effective in our teaching of the other parables that he taught. And so it is, in a similar way, I'm talking about this chapter. We have to be able to think logically. We have to be able to reason as the Scriptures reason in order to be able to understand ourselves and in order to be able to teach others. Does that make sense? Any comment or question? Perfectly clear. Okay. Yes.
And that's the point. Because this is clear. There's a lot of detail given on this subject. Sometimes maybe there's not as much as we'd like to know about something, but this chapter, as you're going to walk us through this, starts. It's the full start to finish, the conversation, the logical, rational process that adult people went through to draw the conclusion. And that's what makes it so important. And you're right, the content may not be all that much of a pinnacle, but the principle, the process here to be used is applicable to everything we do. So I think that's a strong point, and that should be made.
Well, I'm glad you bring it out to reinforce it, because I think so too. And we're going to see it. I mean, we're going to see it as we go through. It's laid out for us. Now, in speaking of the detail, there's a lot of detail that's not here. We know that. For instance, we can see in Galatians 2, there's some detail there that's not here in this chapter. But it's not critical to understanding the development of the reasoning process, as it's explained here. It's not critical to that. It's just some of the detail. For instance, in Galatians 2, it says that Paul met with certain ones first, you know, in a, more of a private meeting. That's not so much brought out in Acts 15. But points such as that, while they're historical points and had to do with Paul's message to the Galatians for his purpose in the Galatian letter, did not have purpose for Luke in his recording of Acts 15 itself. So the letters were written from a different perspective. They had a different purpose in mind, and therefore different details are brought out in the two letters.
This is a continuing thing, because even today the controversy we have over the Ten Commandments is continually going on. That was part of the law of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Even today there's so much discussion over displaying the Ten Commandments, keeping the Ten Commandments, whatever. So it's continuing right on through.
And that's one of the points that I had in mind to bring up at the very end. Is
No.
That's fine. But it's one of the points that I plan to bring up at the end, because it's something that, you know, the church is going to have to continually battle, and that battle is not over. And so we're going to be addressing those kinds of things toward the end. Now, as we look at the problem before the church here in Antioch, to my knowledge, for the first time, false teachings are being put forth. The teachings that we have so far are the teachings of just certain ones of the apostles. We have, you know, sermons by Peter. We don't have sermons by many of the apostles at all. Well, we've got preaching done by Paul, preaching by Stephen. Very limited number of sermons do we have. But this is the first time, to my knowledge, that false teachings have been put forth. And in this respect, the teachings are at fault in the sense that they call into question one's salvation. Notice what it says in 15 and 1, Acts 15 and 1. But some men came from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised, according to the custom of Moses, you what? Cannot be saved. You see? Now, this is affecting one's salvation. You mean I've got to be circumcised? And further on down, it talks about them in verse 5, they had to keep the law of Moses. It was more than just circumcision. They needed to be keeping the law of Moses. And so we're going to look at that point a little bit later back in the Galatian letter itself. So this was critical. It was not just I think you ought to do this, or I think you ought to do that. You know, this was material. It's affecting the salvation of an individual.
Binding it.
Okay? And so, like I said, to my knowledge, this is the first time the church has faced such an issue. What are they going to do with it? They're going to blow it off? Say, oh, it'll go away? You know, are they going to address it? Are they going to meet it head on? What are they going to do with it, you see? So, in effect, crisis is too strong a word. I'm not suggesting that. But it was very important to the church that this challenge to the New Testament teaching that the apostles had been given them be faced. This challenge had to be faced, because the apostles that we're going to see have been teaching one thing, certain things have happened, and now here comes a bold, direct challenge to those things. What's going to happen with it, you see? What's going to happen? So that's what is before us in this chapter. Any comment or question at this point before we actually begin looking at some of the verses? Okay. So notice here, let's take the first four verses here. Some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised, according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And after Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem with the apostles and the elders about this question. So being sent on their way by the church, they pressed through both Phoenicia and Samaria, describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles and brought great joy to all the brothers. So, we notice here that in verse 2, there was no small dissension and debate. Now, how was Barnabas described in Acts chapter 4? Son of consolation. Okay? So here is the exhorter, the son of consolation, involved in serious, serious discussion. It says, no small dissension and debate. Now, I doubt that their debates followed the, what is it followed today? Rules of Robert or something or another? Robert's Rules of Order? Yeah, there's some protocol that men have agreed to. I don't think they had these, at least not that same rule back then. And I don't know that they followed any rule of order. But you can just imagine. You can just imagine what was going on. This says no small dissension, no small debate. Voices may have been raised. I don't know. I wasn't there. Like to have been there, but I wasn't there. So we have to go with what's written. But we've been, perhaps some of us, have been to debates. I don't know if anybody in here has ever participated in a debate or not. But surely many of us have been to them. And there, you know, in our times, they're more toned down. Okay, but I wouldn't characterize what we have today under these terms here. No small dissension. Right. And so I can imagine, you know, that there was, you know, voices raised and people talking excitedly with passion. And certainly there's nothing wrong with excitement and passion. We have to make sure we have passion for the law of Christ. If not, let's just forget it and move on to something else in our lives. But I can imagine the fervency, and also frustrations would come. Trying to make a point and somebody just being totally obstinate to the point you're trying to make. But the point you're trying to make is just so, so logical. Why can't they see it? Why can't they see it? You see? So frustrations can build up in a discussion such as this. So then it's decided by the church in Antioch. We've got to get a handle on this. We've got Gentiles. Now, unlike the church in Jerusalem, this church had many Gentiles in it. I don't know of a comparison between the number of Gentiles and the number of Jews. Remember back in Acts 11, we saw that men from Cyprus and Phoenicia and Cyrene had gone up to Antioch to teach the gospel, and were teaching the gospel in the Gentiles. So, Paul had been there, and we see there in Acts 13 and 1, there were men who were Gentiles. I say they were Gentiles. They were Jews, perhaps. Perhaps they were Gentiles, but certainly, you know, they may have been Jews out of another country. But there were Gentiles in this church in Antioch of Syria. The church in Jerusalem was composed primarily of Jewish Christians. They didn't have the influx of Gentiles the way some of the other cities would have. So this was very, very critical to the church up there in Antioch. And perhaps that's why this stir didn't get raised so much down in Jerusalem. There may not have been that number of Gentiles there. So now wanting to kind of burst out, you know, of their maybe secret meetings and so forth, secretly being brought in, they go up to Antioch and kind of burst out, you see, among this Gentile church. So the church in Antioch says, we got to get a handle on this. We can't let this wait. We can't let this continue going. Because what's going to happen? You're going to start getting hard feelings. And these feelings are going to fester inside of people. And things are going to explode at some point into something that you can't imagine. You know, when you throw a stick of dynamite, you don't necessarily know all the damage. You know there's going to be a boom, but you just don't know all the damage it may cause. And so here the church in Antioch, you know, they got this little stick of dynamite there. They just don't know what all damage this can cause among the brotherhood in that church. So because of this, they determined there to send Paul and Barnabas. Now, can you name one other person that went with them? Titus. Okay? Now, I believe that because Galatians chapter 2 says in the first verse that Titus went down with them. Now, in the... And this is in my notes, but to be honest with you, I have no idea where it is in my notes. So I may be bringing this out of order from where I was intending to bring it. But it says, he took Titus with him because of this revelation. And notice why he said he went. I proclaim, he says, talking about the gospel that proclaimed among the Gentiles. This is Galatians 2 and 2. In order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain. Now, so it looks like, based upon the reading, Paul is going down to Jerusalem. We say down because it's talking more topography-wise, from I think. But anyway, or does it say up? I may be getting it backwards. But anyway, it says it went up to Jerusalem. Okay, because it's up on a mountain. All right, so he says, in order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain. Now, I'm not suggesting by this, and I don't think Paul in his letter is suggesting that he's thinking, well, have I been preaching the truth or not? I need to go down to Jerusalem and find out. That's not the idea. But what was wanted here was that there be a consensus. And I don't mean a 10-2 consensus, but an absolute consensus among Paul as he was doing his work. And the other apostles who were in or around Jerusalem, at least as far as we know, that they were all in agreement on this teaching. That Paul just wasn't out here, you know, through the churches that he'd been through in Antioch and Iconium and Lystra and Derbe and the surrounding places. That he wasn't out here teaching this while the rest of the apostles are back over here teaching something else. It's going to give them a chance to make sure that they're all teaching the same thing. Paul wasn't in doubt of what he was teaching, because his reasoning processes that he brings forth later on in this chapter, he's got those reasoning processes already. Those things just didn't hit him like a bolt of lightning as the debate down in Jerusalem starts. I'm sure that would have been part of the discussion that he raised already in Antioch. So now notice in verse 3, talking about Titus, John, but when Titus, who was with me, was not forced to be circumcised, though he was a Greek. Okay, now notice the idea. See, Titus is brought up in verses 1 and 3. Sandwiched in that is that Paul went by means of revelation in order to assure that he was not running in vain. And then back to Titus again. Why? Well, Titus was a means to determine, you see, in the minds of all these apostles, okay, had Paul's teaching been in vain or not. Paul would have known they rejected his teachings if they rejected Titus. If they accepted Titus as a Gentile Christian without having been circumcised, then they would be in agreement on this teaching, that circumcision was not a part of the gospel of Christ, and that the law of Moses was not to be added on the back of the law of Christ. If they rejected it, if they rejected Titus, then they had a problem. And that's what was going to be important. Now, I don't know if a part of God's revelation was that Titus go or not. I don't know. We're not told that. But it was important that Paul brought it out in verses 1 and verses 3 of Galatians chapter 2. Any question or comment on that? Pardon? Yeah. It was. Right. Yes, sir.
Yeah, maybe we can bring the case of Timothy in Acts 16 in the end to show why Paul had Timothy circumcised, not because of salvation, but because of the Jews who were in those quarters where Paul was going to preach.
Okay.
Now Titus, a Greek, didn't need to be circumcised to show that God, as far as circumcision is concerned, is indifferent.
It's different.
Either way.
Yeah.
So two of Paul's
right.
One circumcised, the other
not. And we're going to see through the study as we continue on in Acts, these two men were vital in their work to assist. I'll use the word assist for a reason. To assist Paul. Okay, they were vital in that. Okay, one circumcised and one not. But see, Timothy, as has been brought out now, was circumcised from the beginning. Okay, and I would suggest that the reason for that is Paul did not intentionally put an issue before someone. He was not going to say, I'm just going to ram Timothy right down their throat with his uncircumcision. I'm going to make them accept this. The gospel doesn't work that way, you see. You know, it's not a ramrod, okay? And so Timothy was circumcised so that it might not become an issue. Now, you've got room for the teaching, but with Timothy, it would never come up as an issue. Now, had it gotten to later on, and he hadn't been, then perhaps it could have become a point of discussion.
I would suppose that this, what he's talking about here, those of reputation, had a private meeting with leadership to be sure they were all on the same page, not a clandestine meeting to try to force something on. Be sure that the leadership was all on the same page before they brought it out to the congregation.
And that very well could be. He's talking about the meeting where Paul and Barnabas, and I'm not saying Titus was in that meeting or not, I don't know, met with probably the elders and the apostles in Jerusalem before the church came together. And they discussed those things. Now, so they go then from down through Phoenicia and Samaria. The brethren in those areas rejoiced, and we would expect Phoenicia to have rejoiced because we've already read about Phoenicia and their work in spreading the gospel in Acts 11. And it says they came to Jerusalem, they were welcomed by the church and the apostles and the elders, and they declared that all had done to them. Now, there's a few things I want to say about verse 4, and I want to say this one thing, and then it'll be time to close for today. They went to the church in Jerusalem because, one, the apostles were there. Okay. The second reason they went there is because the era came from there. So they went there to address the cause of the era. Now, I want to bring this point. It's ironic that the church in Jerusalem that had all this inspiration and revelation with the apostles and so forth would be the church that this era would originate from. You know, one would just think that here we've got all these apostles. We've got, you know, almost a dozen apostles right here. It's impossible for us to have any kind of era in this congregation. If they have it, they're just going to stomp their foot on it and end it right there. Now, I don't know if the apostles had an inkling this was, you know, there, if they knew it was there, or if they just didn't send these men out. You know, it was secret, they were slipping in. We don't know if they knew it. Perhaps God didn't give them any kind of, you know, miraculous insight to this. He just let it develop on its own, knowing that at some point it was going to come out. But it's interesting that in Jerusalem, with all this miraculous revelation they had there, the era would come from them. And we'll stop there, and Lord willing, we'll pick up Wednesday night with verse 4. Thanks.